Machines can be beautiful. Gamay nodded. That was true in many ways, but oddly disturbing in this situation. The beautiful machine seemed a little too human. It appeared to be alive even though it was not moving. The face held a sad quality. The eyes were open and looking up toward the surface, as if waiting for a rescue that hadn't come. It was the last image they recorded, before the signal was lost for good. Chapter 25. Beijing. Wen Li trod carefully as he crossed Tiananmen Square. An early snow had dusted the ground. It painted the sky gray and settled in specks on the fur hats and dark green cloaks of the soldiers guarding Mao's tomb. Wen smiled as he passed them. As the old joke went, no one knew if they were supposed to keep vandals out or the ghost of Chairman Mao trapped within. It is the latter, of course. Mao and true communism were the past. China had transcended that era and become a capitalist dynamo. That was the present, and in Wen's eyes, empire was the future. He passed the spot where Mao's tanks had famously stopped for a single protester who thought he could hold back the might of the state. Nothing marked the man's act. No one even knew who he was or if he was still alive. The moment lived only in people's memories. At the western edge of the square, Wen reached his destination, a vast monolithic building. He climbed a wide swath of triple-tiered steps, passed between towering marble columns, and entered the Great Hall of the People. The monstrous building was over 1,000 feet in width and 600 feet from front to back. Its vaulted roof covered nearly 2 million square feet, larger by far than the American Capitol Building, the United Kingdom's Westminster Hall, or even the giant Smithsonian Museum on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Inside lay several full-sized auditoriums with droll names, such as the Congressional Hall of the National People's Congress. Hundreds of offices, conference rooms, and work areas were spread about. Wen's official, party-sanctioned office lay at the southern end. The guard stiffened at Wen Li's approach, and he was hustled through the checkpoint without a word. He arrived at the end of the hall to find an old friend waiting outside his door. "Admiral," he said as he entered, "to what do I owe the pleasure?" "I've come here with news," the admiral said, "and a warning." Wen had broad influence within the party, but there were those who didn't agree with his vision of China's future. Those who thought the current trajectory was sufficient, they refused to see the limits put on them by American imperialism. "A warning," Wen replied. "Personal or otherwise?" "Both," the admiral said. "Perhaps we should talk inside." Wen opened the door and the two men passed through the outer office and entered Wen's inner sanctum, a hothouse filled with hanging plants, stacks of old books, and aged furniture of the most basic type. Wen offered the admiral a seat in an overstuffed chair as he saw to his plants. "The heat is not healthy for them," he said. "It dries the leaves. But the cold is no better." "The same might be said for men like us," the admiral replied. "Have you ever thought of stepping down?" Wen put the watering can down. "There is no retirement for us," he said. "We die at our posts, one way or another." "Usually after making a large mistake," the admiral said, laughing. Wen shared the joke. A major misstep could bring an end to more than a career in the People's Republic. "Are you suggesting I've made such an error?" "There are rumors of your partnership with Walter Hahn," the admiral said. "And then we have your operation in the East China Sea." "What of it?" Wen said. "It was an experiment. Closed down last year." "Yes," the admiral said. "And at your request, I have spent considerable resources protecting the area. But whatever it was your people did down there, it's begun attracting attention of a most unwanted kind. What are you telling me, Admiral? To begin with, there are problems with the fisheries. 1.5 billion people require a great deal of food to sustain them. Our fishing fleet is the world's largest, and our trawlers scour every sea on the globe. But the banks in the East China Sea have long been one of our most fertile resources. Not anymore. Catches are down every month since you began your experiments. The sea itself is turning barren. The men who run the fishing fleets are complaining. Loudly. I do not answer to fishermen, Wen said coldly. At any rate, our operations took place on the seafloor. Deep sea mining. You know this. Nothing we did could affect the aquatic ecosystem. More than likely, pollution from Shanghai and its 10,000 factories are to blame. Not a tiny operation my people have long since ended. The Admiral looked as if he'd expected this answer. Have you closed it down? You know I have. Then why did my ships detect an American submersible operating directly in your restricted zone? Wen caught himself before overreacting. I would ask you the same question, Admiral, since it's your job to see that they don't. When did this occur? Early this morning, the Admiral said. We picked up a coded transmission on a known American frequency. It was a short-range transmission. In addition, our sonar buoys briefly detected the presence of a vessel, though it was lost before we could locate it. Wen was simultaneously angered and puzzled. How did an American submarine penetrate your defenses? This was not a naval vessel, the Admiral said. The signature is consistent with a small, remotely operated submarine, which would have to be launched from a surface ship or dropped from an aircraft, Wen said. So I'll ask again, how was it not prevented? The Admiral took the veiled accusation of malfeasance in stride. I assure you, comrade, no American aircraft or vessel has entered our zone of control. But an ROV was detected. Wen took a deep breath. The Admiral was a friend. He would not have come here in person only to lie. If the security forces had slipped up and allowed an American incursion, he would have hidden it, burned the reports, and erased the data tapes to prevent his own embarrassment. You insist there were no American ships nearby. None. The answer came to him all at once. He should have known before grilling his old friend. The vehicle was the only clue he really needed. A small submersible, operating without a support vessel in sight. It had to be the NUMA agents who'd flown to Japan for the meeting with the reclusive geologist. Walter Hahn had failed to eliminate the Americans, despite his claims to the contrary. Now, Wen would see to it himself. He stood, signaling the end of the meeting. I appreciate your coming to me, Admiral. I assure you, there's nothing down there for the Americans to find. That said, my people will look into this breach of our territorial rights and respond accordingly. The Admiral stood. Be careful, Wen. This is not the nation it used to be. With wealth comes power, and much wealth has been generated in the last 20 years. The party is not absolute anymore. Other voices are of equal or greater volume. That is the price of economic success. Wen understood the warning. The moguls who'd made great fortunes and those who rode their coattails did not want anything to derail the economic train. They needn't have worried. If his plan came to fruition, not only would the train keep running, but the track ahead would be clear as far as the eye could see. It would happen, he told himself. But first, he had to eliminate the threat. Chapter 26 Shanghai Harbor. Paul stood on the ferry's top deck, staring at the Shanghai skyline. It was a beautiful city, a modern metropolis with glittering buildings, high-speed trains, and multi-lane highways. Paul looked forward to exploring it, if they ever got there. "Any idea what's causing the holdup?" Kame asked. They were a mile from the dock, sitting idly in the harbor, as container ship after container ship passed them in both directions. A pilot had come on board 2 hours ago, but the ferry had yet to move. "No," Paul said, "the engines are still running. I haven't seen any maintenance crews moving about. Maybe we just have to wait our turn. Shanghai is the busiest port in the world, you know." "I'm sure you're right," she said, "but I'm getting the sense this isn't a normal event." Paul had to agree. The crowded deck was rife with murmuring and hushed conversations, most prominently among the Chinese passengers who were going home. The Japanese businessmen and the foreign tourists seemed less concerned. When a patrol boat began moving toward them, every eye on deck focused on it. The lethal-looking vessel was painted battleship gray, armed with multiple guns and missile racks. It flew a military flag. "Something tells me it's not the Port Authority," Gamay said. "What do you say we go back inside and get something to eat?" "Great idea," Paul said. "I think I left something in the cabin anyway." Shouldering their backpacks, they moved against the general direction of the crowd and made their way inside and down the stairs. Reaching their deck, they continued down the hall. As they neared their cabin, an announcement came over the intercom, first in Chinese, then Japanese, then English. "All passengers, return to your cabins. Have your passports and belongings ready for inspection." "That proves it to me," Paul said. "We need to hide, or get off this ship." Paul unlocked the cabin door and ducked inside. Gamay followed, shutting the door behind her. "Not sure our cabin is the best place to lay low." "We're here only for the moment," he said, moving to the window and looking down at the sea. "We're in luck. The patrol boat docked on the other side of the ferry. Get out the transmission cable and tie it securely to something." "Are we swimming for it?" Gamay asked. "Only as a last resort," Paul said. "Let's move quickly. We don't have a lot of time." On a lower deck, the captain of the ferry stood nervously by the main hatch. He watched as the gangway swung toward the patrol boat and locked in place. 20 armed soldiers came across, followed by several officers and a man in civilian clothes. The reasons for the stop had not been given, and the captain knew better than to ask. He held tight to the knowledge that he'd done everything they had ordered him to do, and that, as far as he knew, there was no contraband on his ship. Behind the soldiers and their officers was the older man in civilian clothes, a rumpled suit that looked more comfortable than stylish. The man came across the gangway slowly, clutching the rail for balance. As he stepped onto the ferry, the officers and men stood at attention. "My name is Wen Li," the older man said to the captain. "Do you know who I am?" The captain grew more nervous now than before. Party officials did not visit old ferries in the harbor, not without good reason. He remained at attention as if he were a cadet on his first patrol. Sweat trickled through his hair. "It's an honor to have you aboard, Minister. I'm at your service. What can I do for the party today?" Wen offered a kindly smile. "You may relax, Captain. I require only that you keep the ship secure until my men speak with two of your passengers." From inside his jacket pocket, Wen produced a folded sheet of paper and handed it to the captain. On it were two names, odd-sounding names to the captain, either European or American. The captain called for the purser. In a moment, they had the cabin number. "I'll take you there myself," the captain insisted. They went up three decks and then walked aft along the main hall. Passengers stood and gawked and then moved out of the captain's way as he came toward them with the armed soldiers close behind. A glance back told the captain only a third of the troop was following. He suspected others had been dispersed around the ship to block possible avenues of escape. Moving quickly, The captain checked the numbers on each door, stopping one door from the cabin they were looking for. "It's that one," he said, pointing and stepping aside. Wen nodded and motioned to one of the officers. The soldiers moved past them. Weapons were drawn, batons readied. One man stood back and then lunged forward. His swift kick hit the door right beside the handle. The door flew open, the flimsy lock coming apart in the effort. Two soldiers rushed in with their batons. No combat ensued. No shouts of desperation or demands for submission. Just chatter between the soldiers. The tiny bathroom and small closet took only seconds to check. One of the soldiers emerged. "Cabin secure," he said. "They're not here." Wen stepped through the door and the ferry's captain followed him. He found the cabin in great disorder. Furniture had been tossed about. Clothing and boots lay near two hastily discarded packs, the contents of which seemed to have been rummaged through and dumped. A thin black cable had been tied around the bed frame. It crossed the far side of the cabin, stretching toward the window and vanishing beneath a gauzy curtain that wafted in the gentle breeze. Wen put his hand on the cable and followed it. Pulling the curtain aside, he discovered that the inner window frame had been bent back and forced open. The captain studied the damage. "The windows only open 8 inches." "Obviously, that was not enough," Wen said. The captain looked outside. The cable hung straight down the side of the ship, where it vanished into the dark water of the harbor. It was evident what had occurred. "They're in the water," Wen told the officers. "Get the boats out to search for them. Immediately." "It's a mile to shore," one of the officers replied. "The current is strong and the water is like ice this time of year. Surely they'll drown if they try to swim for it." Wen shook his head. "These Americans are part of NUMA. They're trained divers and strong swimmers. They may have equipment, compact rebreathers or oxygen bottles. Do not underestimate them. I want police patrols along the shore and every boat you can requisition involved in the search." As the captain watched, the officer put a radio to his mouth and made the call. In the meantime, Wen took one more look around the cabin, made a brief search of the backpacks, and then left without another word. The soldiers followed him out, and the captain was left in the stateroom alone. He glanced out the window again. There was no sign of anyone swimming, but the patrol boat could be heard coming around from the far side of the ferry. American agents, trained divers, high-ranking officials from the party boarding his ship. It was more excitement than he'd seen in years. For a moment, he wondered exactly what was going on, but after thinking twice, he realized it was better if he didn't know. Chapter 27 Gamay listened to the water lapping against the side of the ship. It wasn't long before the reassuring and repetitive sound was overcome by the roar of the patrol boat. It raced around the bow of the ferry and charged along the starboard side, slowing only as it neared the cable dangling from the window of their cabin. From high above it, Gamay grinned. "Pretty smooth idea, dropping the cable out the window and making it look like we'd gone overboard. They think we're swimming for shore. They're searching for us now." The anchor chain locker was crowded, oily, and mildly claustrophobic, with several hundred feet of heavy chain piled up inside it. It was no place for comfort, but it made a terrific hiding spot. "I'd have preferred something in the cargo hold," Paul said, "but those soldiers we spotted changed my mind." They'd narrowly avoided one gang of soldiers in the forward section of the cargo hold, and after catching sight of a second squad, made a change of plans. Coming forward, they pried open the hatch to the locker and climbed inside. As Paul pulled the hatch shut, he made sure to prevent it from latching. "The pièce de résistance was all your idea," Paul said. "If you hadn't mentioned it, I'd have kept my boots on." He wiggled his toes for emphasis. It had been Gamay's suggestion to dump their boots, backpacks, and other belongings in the room, with the exception of the laptop computer, which was now wrapped in a plastic bag and tucked under Paul's shirt. "Nobody swims with all their luggage," she said. "It would have been a dead giveaway. I'm just glad they took the bait." "Can you see what they're doing?" Paul asked. Large piles of heavy chain surrounded them, filling up the room and exiting through an opening called a hawse hole. Gamay was able to peer through the gap between the chain and the hull to see most of the starboard side. "They've moved toward the stern," she said. "They're checking under the fantail." A moment later, the boat disappeared around the aft end. As it did, a second boat raced out toward the ferry, and then a third. "Calling in reinforcements," she said. Shortly afterward, a distant boom reached them, muffled and distorted by the hull. Over the next few moments, they heard several more, each farther off than the last. The impact reverberated through metal skin, as if the two of them were sitting inside a giant drum. "What do you think all that's about?" Gamay asked. "Fishing expedition," Paul said, "using dynamite or grenades." "Trying to blow us out of the water?" Paul nodded. "Not a bad strategy, considering how vulnerable an unprotected diver is to shockwaves." Because of the way seawater transmitted sound and force, a grenade explosion 100 feet off would rupture eardrums and cause concussions. Any closer, and it might kill them outright. The explosions continued sporadically for at least the next 20 minutes, and perhaps even longer, but all external sound was drowned out when the ferry's engines came back to life. Soon the big ship began to move. "Looks like they're finally going to dock this ferry." "I'd be happier if they were sending us back to Japan," Paul said, "even considering the accommodations. But we couldn't be that lucky. They'll dock the ship all right. Then they'll offload the passengers with plenty of extra eyes at customs to watch for us in the crowd." "And when they don't see us in the line," Gamay began, "or spot our bodies floating on the surface after all those makeshift depth charges?" "They'll search the ship again," Paul said, "which means we either stay here until the ferry goes back to Osaka, which could be days, or longer if they quarantine the vessel, or we find a way to get off this boat without drawing any attention to ourselves." "I vote for fresh air," Gamay said. "I know they'll probably just tie up to the pier, but I'd rather not be in here if they drop that anchor." "Deafening and dangerous, at the very least," Paul said. "We know they've searched the cargo hold already. I say we make our way back there and find a nice container to hide in."
"Great idea," she said. "Lead on."
It would take 20 minutes to work their way from the anchor chain locker to the cargo deck, where they found an unlocked cargo container filled 3/4 of the way up with sacks of rice. They crawled in on top of the bags, moved a few of them around to present a false wall, as if the bags were stacked all the way to the roof, and waited. Breathing was no problem, as rice shipments required plentiful ventilation to prevent condensation from wetting the grains and spoiling them. Eventually the ferry docked, and a group of stevedores came on board to begin the unloading. It took hours. At one point the container doors were opened and then closed. Then the container was loaded onto a flatbed and driven off the ship. When all movement had stopped, Gamay figured they had traveled about 10 miles. "We seem to have been placed into storage," she said. They listened for any sounds, but heard none. "Let's find out where we are," she said. Paul did the honors, crawling across the sacks of rice to the corner of the container, where he could gaze through one of the ventilation slits. "Warehouse," he said. "I can't see anything but other containers. If it's all quiet out there, we should probably make our move." After shoving the heavy bags aside, they opened the door a crack. The warehouse was dark and looked deserted.
"All clear," Gamay said. "I say we make our way to the American consulate. If we can get inside unnoticed, we can get this information back to Washington and escape with our lives."
Chapter 28. Mountain District, Japan. Superintendent Nagano followed Ushione using the tracking coin. It was an ingenious piece of electronic design,
transmitting a signal on the cell phone band and sending a pulse only once every 30 seconds, which made it virtually undetectable to any person holding it. At a long distance, the signal was relayed by the nation's vast network of cell towers, but closer in, Nagano used a dedicated receiver to home in on the GPS coordinates being transmitted from the coin. The signal led him out of Tokyo and onto a twisting mountain road, when the assassin stopped at a gas station to get fuel and use the restroom. Nagano snuck up to his car and placed a second transmitter under the bumper, in case Oni used or lost the coin. With two transmitters in place, Nagano dropped well back of his quarry, keeping out of sight and waiting for the opportune moment to arrest him. To his surprise, Ushioni continued higher into the mountains, heading to the foothills of Mount Fuji, before turning onto an obscure side road and finally stopping an hour later. Nagano studied the satellite image. It displayed nothing but a forested hillside. A yellow icon suggested a small guest house was hidden beneath the trees, as was a natural onsen, a traditional hot spring, mineral bath. In addition, a Shinto shrine lay nearby. Nagano drove past the guest house, continued several miles up the road, and then pulled over. When 30 minutes had passed without any movement from either of the two transmitters, he doubled back and approached the inn cautiously. Ushioni's car remained in the lot, along with 20 other vehicles. The busy state of the guest house didn't surprise Nagano. Both the hot springs and the Shinto shrines were popular spots to visit. Some drew millions of visitors per year, though this particular shrine was smaller and all but unknown. According to the information he was able to pull up on the computer, it was not even open to the public. All in all, he found it a strange place for Ushioni to stop. Nagano checked on the location of the original transmitter just in case Ushioni had come here to switch cars. The tracking coin was signaling him from a spot inside the guest house. Convinced that Ushioni was there, Nagano parked in the lot and called his most trusted subordinate. "I've tracked the demon to a shrine in the mountains," he explained. "Bring two of your best men. We'll arrest him tonight." After being assured that reinforcements would be there soon, Nagano loosened his tie and waited. Ushioni stood in a small room, pressed against the wall, and peering through a tiny gap between the curtain and the window frame. Seeing no movement in the parking lot or out on the street, he eased the curtain back into place and walked away from the glass. He opened a small case, pulled out a pair of throwing knives, and slipped them into slots in the loose jacket he wore. He then closed the case, checked his watch, and left the room. He still had time. Plenty of time. He made his way through the inn and out onto a narrow path that led to the onsen. Disrobing completely, he showered first and then lowered himself into the bubbling water of the natural hot spring. He sat with his back against the wet black rock that surrounded the bath as the steam enshrouded him and obscured anything beyond the rim of bubbling waters. After several minutes, a shape came down the path, emerging from the fog beyond. The new arrival wore a white robe and an oddly shaped black hat known as a crow hat, or karasu. He was a Shinto priest. "Shinsoku," Oni said, addressing the man by a term that meant employee of the gods. The term was reserved for those who took care of the shrines. "I was beginning to doubt that you would come." The priest was staring at Oni's colorful tattoos. "You are the one who contacted us." "Yes," Oni said. "You have asked for the purification ritual," the priest said, confirming. "Who would need it more than I?" Oni said. The priest nodded. "It is my duty to guide you." "I have already bathed," Ushioni said. "What must I do next?" "Put on your robe and follow me. I will show you." Ushioni climbed out of the waters, pulled on a robe, and put his feet into a pair of slippers. Clutching his folded clothes in one arm, he followed the priest on a path that took them back into the woods, away from the inn and up toward the shrine. They traveled for half a mile, walking between tall stands of bamboo, until they came to a series of vermilion-colored gates known as torii. Each gate had two vertical posts, painted in the traditional red-orange scheme. They were capped by a black lintel with upturned ends, from which oil lanterns hung, illuminating the path in a flickering light. Beyond the first torii was another, and then another. Some were old and dilapidated, others were newer. Inscriptions carved into them displayed the names of the families that had paid for them in hopes of securing good fortune. "Is it true that the Tokugawa family once supported this shrine?" Ushione asked.
"Tokugawa?" the priest said.
"No. I'm afraid that's only a myth." They crested a hill and the path leveled off. Passing under the final gate, they arrived at the shrine itself. A small covered structure with an altar beneath it. A water-filled trough stood off to the side, and two carved stone animals guarded the approach. Ushione stepped toward it.
"You must wash first," the priest said.
Ushione felt the sting of being told what to do.
"I told you. I've already bathed."
"The hands must be clean," the priest said.
Reluctantly, Ushione placed his clothes aside and dipped his hands in the trickling water. The water was frigid, completely opposite to the hot bath he'd come from. He pulled his hands out, then shook them off and glared at the priest.
"I've brought an offering."
"You must rinse your mouth as well," the priest said.
Ushione ignored the request and pulled out the marker chip that Han had given him, a marker that he'd chosen not to redeem.
"What is it?" the priest asked.
"A relic of my former life."
The priest looked him over sternly, studying him like a disapproving schoolmaster.
"Your past is a criminal one."
"And my future," Ushione thought.
"I wish to escape who I am and reinvent myself as someone new. Isn't that what you're here for?"
"So it is," the priest said.
He picked up a ladle, filled it with water and handed it to Oni.
"But you must rinse your mouth. It is required."
Ushione had played the part long enough. He tossed the ladle down in disgust and stepped toward the old man, grabbing him by the loose vestments.
"You are possessed of an evil spirit," the priest said.
"You have no idea," Ushione growled. "Now take me to the sanctuary. I wish to view what the Tokugawa family placed in your possession."
The priest squirmed, but his feeble strength was no match for Ushione's.
"There is nothing there to see," the priest stammered. "Nothing there for a criminal to steal. Just wisdom, which you reject."
"I'll be the judge of that," Ushione said.
The priest tried to free himself, but Ushione slammed him against the trough, stunning him. The frail man went limp, and Oni pulled his garment open. Around the priest's neck hung a set of keys. Oni grabbed and ripped them forth hard enough to snap the chain on which they hung. The priest cried out, but Ushione covered his mouth and then snapped his neck with a swift twist of his arms. Dropping the body to the ground, Ushione looked around him. A cool wind rustled through the bamboo, but other than that, the forest was quiet. Certain that he was alone, Oni took off his robe and then removed the priest's garment and pulled it over his shoulders. The robe fit snugly. Oni was much larger than the dead priest, and try as he might, he could not place the strange hat in a manner that looked normal. He slid the strap under his chin and left it crooked. Before leaving the shrine, he dropped the naked priest in the trough. "Cleanse yourself, Shinsoku." With the evidence of his first crime hidden, Oni tossed the brass casino marker toward the shrine, picked up his folded clothes once again, and continued on the path toward the Shinto monastery up above. Superintendent Nagano was glad to see the white van pull in beside him. His most trusted lieutenant and two plainclothes officers got out.
"Is he still here?" the lieutenant asked.
Nagano pointed toward the hills.
"He's gone up to the shrine."
The lieutenant looked suspicious. What would a man like Ushioni want at a shrine?
I doubt he's after forgiveness, Nagano said. And you're sure it's him?
I saw him twice.
It's the man Zavala described, Nagano said. I want to take him alive, preferably out in the woods where there are no civilians.
The lieutenant nodded. He carried a pistol and what they called a shock stick, essentially a high-powered taser on a long pole. Very useful in crowd control. The two officers had Heckler and Koch submachine guns, derivatives of the famous MP5, except with a much shorter barrel, a feature that made them excellent for close-quarters combat. Nagano pulled out his own pistol. He was tired of waiting. Let's go. They moved quickly and silently, passing the vacant onsen and climbing their way up the bamboo-lined path to the thicket of Torii gates. They arrived at the shrine without incident. There they stopped. But all they found was the hotel robe hastily rolled up and stuffed under the altar. He was wearing this, Nagano said. He must have changed back into his own clothing. Look at this, one of the men called from beside the trough. Nagano rushed over, and the two of them lifted the dead priest out of the purifying water. Any doubt that this is the demon we're tracking should be gone now.
Are you still getting a signal? The lieutenant asked.
Nagano checked the display on his tablet. They were not in range of any cell towers there in the mountains, but with the direct seeking mode, he was able to locate the tracking coin. He's in the sanctuary. They rushed along the path, arriving at the entrance to the monastery building only to find the front door ajar. Candles flickered here and there. A small fire burned in a stone hearth, but there was no sign of Ushioni. Or anyone else, for that matter.
I don't like it, the lieutenant said. It's too quiet. Where are the priests? One of the men asked.
Nagano couldn't answer that. Some of the smaller shrines were sparsely attended or even left alone, but the sanctuary and the candles told him this one was occupied. He clicked off the safety on his pistol.
We can only assume the worst.
The lieutenant nodded.
Which way?
Nagano checked the scanner. The red dot blinked steady and still.
He's in the back. Let's go.
They moved down the hall and came upon the body of another priest. He lay in a pool of blood just inside one of the doors. They found three more in the next room. Two more bodies and a pair of ransacked rooms confirmed that Ushioni was on a killing spree. Nagano paused and made a slashing motion across his neck. All thoughts of taking Ushioni alive had vanished. They would shoot him on sight. If he lived, so be it. If he didn't, he would be getting what he deserved. Nagano crept forward. They were nearing the end of the hall. The flashing indicator on Nagano's screen told them Ushioni was in the room on the left. For the first time, Nagano could hear movement. He braced himself, took a deep breath, and then lunged forward, kicking the door open. He saw a figure dressed in black who was hunched over a desk. He raised his weapon and was about to fire when the figure turned. It wasn't the face of a killer, but another of the elderly priests. The man was tied to the chair with an electrical cord. On the desk in front of the prisoner, sitting on a folded white garment, was a tiny circular object with a hole in the middle. The tracking coin. Realization came too late. A shout of pain from behind him confirmed it. Nagano spun in time to see the flash of a sword decapitate his lieutenant and take the arm off of another of the men. The third officer was already on the ground, a throwing knife sticking out of his back. Nagano fired once but missed, and the bullet buried itself uselessly in the wall. The flashing sword hit the side of the pistol before Nagano could fire again. It took off the tips of his fingers and knocked the gun across the room. Nagano dove for the weapon, trying to grasp it with his right hand, but Ushioni was faster. A kick to the ribs sent Nagano over onto his side. He wound up against the desk with the point of the ancient sword pressed up against his neck. He froze as the demon stared down at him. He expected to be run through at any second, But instead Ushioni laughed and held him there like an insect under a pin.
"Looking for this," Ushioni said, as he picked up the tracking coin.
Nagano said nothing. He was grasping his hand to stop the bleeding and desperately thinking of a way to reach the pistol. The truth was, any movement would split the skin of his throat.
Ushioni twisted the sword a fraction and blood began to trickle down Nagano's neck.
"Did you really think I wouldn't notice you following me? I saw you below me on the switchback road. I waited for you at the gas station and watched as you placed that beacon on my car. I must admit, it made me wonder how you had been tracking me in the first place. Then I found your little coin."
As Oni spoke, he held the coin in his hand.
"Close," he added. "Very, very close. But it's not quite as heavy as the real thing."
He flung it at Nagano, hitting him in the face.
"Go ahead and kill me," Nagano said. "It won't save you. You slaughter monks and policemen. You'll have nowhere to hide after this. Not now that your face is known."
Instead of killing him, Ushioni crouched and picked up the shock stick, testing its weight in his free hand.
"Once they see what you do," he said, "they'll forget all about me."
With that, he jammed the shock stick into Nagano's chest and sent a powerful wave of electricity through him. A second wave followed, and then a third. Nagano couldn't do anything but spasm with each shock and try to endure the pain. He lasted several minutes, and then his world faded mercifully to black.
Chapter 29. Nagasaki. The city of Nagasaki was sandwiched between the mountains and the ocean at the western tip of Japan. With limited space to build outward, its neighborhoods rose up into the hills, where they gazed at one another across a narrow bay. The geography gave Nagasaki a compact old-world feel, reminiscent of San Francisco. It was a feeling enhanced by the bustling port and the high-decked suspension bridge, coated in orange paint that linked the two sides together. Kurt, Joe, and Akiko arrived in the city driving another car from Kenzo's collection, a 1972 Skyline GTR. The four-door sedan was one of the first truly collectible cars produced on the island. Still, it was bare bones compared to the Bentley.
"One might say our vehicular status seems to be trending in the wrong direction," Joe said from the back seat. "But I think I prefer this to the Bentley."
Akiko turned to Joe from the passenger seat.
"I'm glad you appreciate it," she said. "This is the first car I restored for Master Kenzo. It was a labor of love."
"The lines are classic and aggressive," Joe said. "Just the way I like them."
Kurt rolled his eyes and took the ramp to the bridge. A rental car would have been just fine. It would have included a better heater. Akiko shook her head.
"Rental cars are too automated. Did you know the car companies track their whereabouts using RFID tags and the signals from the satellite radio receivers? They don't need LoJack or any other dedicated system to watch you. And many newer cars are equipped with remote operating authority. They can turn off your engine from a computer terminal whenever they like."
Kurt grinned. Something about conspiracy theorists warmed his heart. Which they probably wouldn't do as long as Rudy keeps paying the credit card bills. "Anyway, we're not trying to sneak up on anyone. Our whole plan is based on speaking with Walter Hahn face to face."
"And just how do you intend to make that happen?" Joe asked.
"I'm going to walk right up to him and ask him for help." Kurt said no more. They took the Hirado Bridge, crossed Nagasaki Bay, and then drove down toward a sprawling facility that lay dockside. The gleaming complex took up 100 acres and looked more like the futuristic headquarters of an advanced civilization than a factory. Geometrically arranged concrete buildings were set up in a campus-style arrangement. A sculpture garden lay between them, complete with walking paths and gently flowing water in narrow chutes. A track for testing automated vehicles was visible behind the facility. its snaking turns offset by a long straightaway that ran along the waterfront.
That's Han's new facility, Kurt noted, owned and operated by his company, China Nippon Robotics, a joint venture with a group of wealthy Japanese investors. It officially opens today, first of two big ceremonies. The Prime Minister of Japan, the Mayor of Nagasaki, and several members of Parliament are on hand. Each of them will be giving a short speech, which, if you know politicians, means a long, drawn-out talk.
They came all the way down here for a ribbon cutting? Joe asked.
There's more on tap, Kurt said. The cooperation agreement between China and Japan is being signed here tomorrow. Not at the factory, but at a place called the Friendship Pavilion, also built with Han's money.
How to win friends and influence nations, Joe said.
Exactly, Kurt replied. But it gives us a chance to move around unnoticed. They're running this whole thing like a trade show. Both events are open to the public. That includes us.
Kurt navigated the narrow streets, drove onto the grounds, and was directed toward an underground parking garage. After parking, they left the car, found an escalator, and emerged into the hum of a bustling crowd.
Lights flashed all around them. Small machines moved here and there. A holographic face projected on a veil of mist greeted them.
"The future is closer than you think," its recorded voice said.
Ahead of them, neon lights and pulsating music made it seem as if they were walking into a club. Artificial arms, complete with painted fingernails, stretched from a wall, offering to shake hands.
Akiko shook her head.
"Akomo," she whispered, using the Japanese word for nightmare. "It's like the seventh ring of hell."
Kurt noticed her demeanor. It wasn't a phobia or discomfort, just a sort of resigned disgust, like a pious man walking into Sodom and Gomorrah. "Consider this an educational opportunity. At least you'll know what you're missing."
"Or escaping from," she said.
After picking up badges at the front desk, they were given headsets that could be tuned to a specific language. As they approached the various booths and displays, a recording was triggered in the headset, explaining what they were looking at. The first booth was a generic industrial display. "Advanced robotics will eliminate the need for man to perform many tedious tasks," the recording told them. "Within a decade, our robotics will replace the boredom of long-distance driving, the back-breaking labor of working in a warehouse, delivering packages, or hauling away trash. Even the construction of roads will be automated by giant machines, freeing humanity from the burden."
"And freeing them from their paychecks," Joe said.
"Not a fan of automation?" Kurt asked.
"Not if it renders me obsolete."
"Now you're thinking my way," Akiko said.
They wandered to another section of the facility where a crowd had gathered. "Here we have the service version of our latest human assistance model, the HAM-9X. As the light came up, they saw a female form in a French maid's outfit. The face was soft and realistic, although quite expressionless. The eyes were bright, the lips plum-colored and supple.
"My name is 9X," the robot said, the lips moving as she spoke.
A wink followed, which pleased all the men in the crowd.
"I'm here to handle your every need."
Kurt was surprised by the human quality of the voice. It sounded neither pre-recorded nor computer-generated. He moved closer and studied the machine. In a simulated kitchen, it rinsed and dried dishes and unloaded several bags of groceries, putting everything into its proper place. It then began to make a pot of freshly ground coffee, all without spilling a single grind.
"I think we've found the solution to your girlfriend drought," Kurt said to Joe.
Akiko gave Joe a sideways look, and Joe shook his head, protesting vigorously.
"I like to work on machines. I'm not interested in dating one."
"How wonderful," Akiko said, her voice dripping with sarcasm. "Soon we won't need other humans for anything. We can all live on our own, surrounded by mechanical servants."
"Not me," Joe said. "I prefer a human touch."
Kurt had to laugh. He'd never seen Joe so smitten. He glanced at his watch. We need to get over to the ceremony if we're going to catch Han's speech. They moved on, passing several other interesting displays and making their way to the Great Hall. It was standing room only in the auditorium. Up on the dais, Walter Han was speaking not about robotics, but about opportunities for Japan and China to cooperate. The two great powers of Asia will change the world in this coming century. But first we must change our relationship. The past must be forgotten. The mistakes of the previous century left to history, so as not to derail the future. Interesting subject, considering all the tension in the South China Sea and the dispute over the Senkaku Islands, Joe noted. Han soon touched on that. The Chinese government is now moving to end several impasses, he said. A new proposal granting Japan full control over the islands in question is being prepared. No longer will we fight over trivial things, when partnership can bring both great nations so much more. A wave of applause went up.
He speaks as if he holds all the power, Akiko replied.
Nagano said he has a quasi-diplomatic status.
But did you hear the word he chose? Granting Japan control over her own islands.
Akiko was offended.
The arrogance drips from him.
Kurt didn't argue. He just turned back to Han and listened. Eventually he finished and the ribbon was cut. China Nippon Robotics was officially open for business, and the celebration began. While the political figures vanished, hustled off stage by their security teams, Han came forward, glad-handing his way through the crowd, stopping and talking to people on the way.
"Time for me to go introduce myself," Kurt said.
Joe stepped aside.
"We'll meet you outside in the hall. Good luck."
The auditorium was emptying as Kurt made his way down the aisle. The longer Han was delayed, the more effort he put into leaving. He shook hands more briskly and cut every conversation short. He brushed off one man with a quick smile and a bow, and then turned to go, only to find Kurt blocking his path.
"Walter Han," Kurt said, proffering a hand.
"So glad I caught you. Excellent speech, by the way." Han's face was a mask that didn't reveal much, but a look of surprise had appeared for the briefest of instants.
"I'm sorry," Han said. "Do I know you?"
"Not personally," Kurt said. "My name is Austin, Kurt Austin. I'm the head of special projects at NUMA, the National Underwater and Marine Agency, based out of Washington, D.C. You and I haven't met face to face, but I, or should I say my technical people, are big fans of your work."
Han's demeanor went from annoyed to pleasant.
"How, exactly?"
Kurt played the part to the hilt. "We use a growing number of robotic and automated vehicles in our deep-sea efforts. We are currently beginning an important expedition into anomalies we've discovered in the East China Sea." Kurt hoped to spook Han, but the mention of the East China Sea brought nothing from the man. He remained taciturn and opaque. "China Nippon Robotics would be honored to work with an organization as renowned as NUMA," Han replied. "In fact, we have several aquatic models designed for pipeline inspection and deep-sea drilling that you may find useful. Call my office on Monday. I'll put you in touch with the operations director."
"I'm afraid Monday will be too late," Kurt said. "We launch tomorrow. We feel it's urgent not to waste any time."
"Why the rush?" Han asked, his brow knitted together for effect.
"The anomalies I'm speaking of are geologic in nature," Kurt explained. "A series of inexplicable earthquakes. Considering the region's history with tsunamis and other tectonic disasters, we feel the investigation cannot be delayed. In other words, we need to know what's going on down there. Any chance you and I could talk later tonight?"
Han shook his head.
"Not possible. But leave your contact information with my office. If the chance to help does come up, CNR would be glad to oblige."
He shook Kurt's hand again.
"Best of luck. Enjoy the expo. Excuse me."
With that, Han brushed past. He continued down the aisle, accompanied by several of his people, and pushed out into the hall. Kurt let him go before meeting up with Joe and Akiko.
Well, Joe asked, has the tree been shaken?
It has, Kurt said. Unfortunately, it turned out to be an oak. He didn't bat an eye.
Did you lay it on thick?
Any thicker and you'd need a road grader to spread it.
Maybe Superintendent Nagano was right,
Akiko said. To continue your tree metaphor, perhaps we're barking up the wrong one. Kurt wasn't ready to give in. Let's give it time to work. If he's involved, he'll respond, one way or another.
And if he's clean?
Then he'll go back to his office, laugh about the crazy American he just met, and we'll be back to square one.
Chapter 30 CNR Factory.
Han made it from the ceremony to his office without further interruption. He shut the door firmly and took a seat at his desk. In silence, he contemplated the interruption he'd just dealt with. Something had to be done about the interference from Austin and Numa. He placed his finger on a scanner built into his desktop. After reading his fingerprint, it confirmed his identity and released the locks on his desk. From the second drawer down, he pulled out a special phone and plugged it into a dedicated jack in the side of his computer. With a few taps of the keyboard, he initiated an encryption program and then placed a call. A yellow icon appeared on screen as the initial connection was made. The symbol turned green once the encryption codes were accepted and matched.
"Secure line," a voice said from the other end.
"Secure line," Han repeated. "Connect me to the minister."
"Stand by."
As he waited, Han loosened his tie, which had begun to feel constricting around his neck. That done, he poured himself a drink and took a large gulp from the glass. The voice came over the computer speaker.
"I have the minister, sir. Go ahead."
The line cleared, and he was connected to Wen Li at his office in Beijing.
"We have a problem," Han said. "We need to call off the operation."
There was a brief moment of static before Wen Li replied.
"We have problems on several fronts," Wen admitted, "but it's too late for us to turn back. Things have been put in motion that cannot be stopped."
"We are facing risk of imminent exposure," Han said. "Kurt Austin confronted me today regarding a geological anomaly on the bottom of the East China Sea."
"That would not surprise me," Wen said, "except that you told me Austin had been eliminated."
Han had known they were alive since the incident at the casino, but he hadn't reported that information back to Wen.
"I was led to believe they'd been killed in the fire," he said. "They must have falsified their deaths and continued to investigate. An amateurish ploy."
"Which you seem to have fallen for." Han burned with indignation.
"Maybe you're not grasping the magnitude of what I've just said. Austin came here, to my place of business. He walked right up to me, only moments after I finished my appearance with the Japanese Prime Minister. That cannot be a coincidence. It means they've connected CNR and me to the events in the Serpent's Jaw. They intend to survey the area. It will lead to the mining site."
"A bluff," Wen said.
"How can you be so sure?"
"Because they've already surveyed it," Wen explained, "and they found nothing." Han was stunned. Apparently he wasn't the only one keeping information to himself.
"How and when did this occur?"
"Yesterday," Wen replied. "We detected signals emanating from an ROV. Sonar was intermittent due to the small size of the submersible. But we're almost certain that they found the original mining site." Han put a hand to his temple and massaged away the growing pain.
"How could this happen? I thought naval units of the PLA had that area locked down."
Wen explained the breach with grudging admiration.
"I will admit they found a novel way around our net, a method we hadn't considered, but in hindsight, their discovery will prove irrelevant."
"Not if they send the information back to Washington."
"That will never occur," Wen promised.
The NUMA agents are here in Shanghai. We'll soon have them in custody. They will be charged with espionage and used as bargaining chips. And, to their dismay, they will find they've thrown their lives away for nothing.